This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A slew of legislation moved forward this week at the Capitol. Lawmakers passed measures to allow fracking in the state, and plans for a public-private partnership for economic development gained traction. Legislators are also close to eliminating the Common Core curriculum in North Carolina schools. But will Governor McCrory approve all of their changes? He says the repeal of Common Core is not a smart move, and he criticized the Senate's proposal on Medicaid. We're joined by our news roundtable to talk about these issues and more. John Elliston, a reporter with the Carolina Public Press in Asheville. Welcome back, John.
Hi, thank you, Frank.
WRAL's Capitol Bureau Chief Laura Leslie back with us. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Frank.
And Jorge Valencia from WUNC, our Capitol reporter. Jorge, good
hey,
to
Frank.
See you. Let me start with you. Common Core, tell us what they're looking at and why the legislature wants to eliminate this kind of Common Core curriculum.
Well, Common Core, as we know, is a set of standards that states across the country are using to say what students should be able to do in every grade. Proponents say that these are very high standards. Opponents here in the state say that North Carolina should have its own set of standards. Now, the House and the Senate both passed bills that would conceivably repeal Common Core. The bills are very similar, with one stark difference in the Senate. The Senate leaves the door open for later on down the road to study what could be the best standards for the state. Maybe even possibly Common Core would be the best standards in the state. So those bills were passed this week. They're going to go to conference, and then we'll see how they reconcile that.
And an issue here, of course, is that these are national standards, and what state lawmakers are saying, what's that got to do with us here in North Carolina? Laura?
Right. I mean, the whole idea was to have national standards. So, for example, if you're a military family, you're moving from state to state, you know, it's easier for you to for your kids to be in the right, you know, the right place, have the right skills. The idea was to raise the standards for all kids, right? And the idea that the kids would achieve higher, and you know, in response. The trouble is that there is sort of a belief out there among some people that this is sort of socialism, that it is a takeover by the Obama, they call it Obama Core. A takeover, although it was started under George W. Bush, actually. But, you know, that is a takeover of state sovereignty, and that some of the things that are being taught are very ideological. Some of them are also not appropriate, people feel. And so there's been a big push from the right and from some on the left to get rid of these things. There's, you know, the narrative that you hear a lot is we jumped into this with the best of intentions because everybody thought this would be a great idea. And now that the rubber has hit the road, you know, we need to step back, take a second look and see if this is really the way we want to go.
The guy who likes to tell us he's in the middle, Governor McCrory, doesn't think this is such a good idea to reject Common Core. Tell us about that.
Well, he doesn't. And I'll tell you, the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce doesn't either. They've been pushing. He's been pushing. The idea, you know, that he and they are operating on is that these higher standards are going to be good for the state in the future. In terms of economic development and force of workforce recruitment, job recruitment, that lowering our standards is not the way to make the state stand out for its future prosperity. But the folks who want to repeal it say we're not necessarily lowering the standards. We just don't like these particular standards. So, you know, right now the governor is in a tough place because, as Jorge was saying, you've got a House and Senate bill that have both passed the chambers that both say repeal, although the Senate, as you said, leaves the door open. But at this point, if they sent them to him, you know, there's not a lot he could do.
John Elliston, Carolina Public Press in Asheville. I want to switch gears now and talk about a report that you wrote this week in the Carolina Public Press that follows up on news that we've known a little bit about, a Buncombe County Republican lawmaker who has created his own media company and did that a while ago. Tell us about that.
Representative Tim Moffitt represents parts of Buncombe County, and he's a very active legislator. He sponsored scores of bills last year, and on the side, as a side project, he created a media company that almost exclusively does its services for his fellow House Republican colleagues. He's got about 30 fellow representatives that he runs all their social media for, their websites, Facebook and Twitter and what have you. It's a very unusual arrangement whereby a legislator is selling his services to his colleagues.
And unusual, but illegal or unethical. Is anything wrong with that?
The consensus seems to be that it's novel, it's innovative, it's hard to judge it by a lot of the standards we've had in the past because it is so new. But it hasn't tripped any legal or ethical wires thus far, unless folks take issue with the very notion of legislators profiting from services they provide to each other.
And there was a question about taking money from his campaign fund and funneling it to his media business, but there's nothing illegal about that either.
Yeah, as it happens, he is his number one client, which is to say that in the past year and a quarter, he spent $9,500 of his own campaign funds to pay his own media company.
So one of the interesting things about this, though, John, is that he started this company saying that he is kind of a Tea Party style representative from Buncombe County, doesn't feel that he's being adequately represented in the media. The media is leaving out the voice of the far right, and he needed to form this media company. And I just wonder, again, Laura, this kind of points to a perceived difference, maybe one that the governor himself is trying to promote, a difference between the governor and the far right within the legislature. Maybe it comes up in this Common Core discussion. Maybe it's part of the Medicaid discussion. We can talk about that in a second. Is there increasing tension between the governor and the right, or is that a kind of a mirage for us?
I think there is a lot of tension. And I would say the bulk of the tension happens to be between the Senate leadership and the governor. The House leadership has sort of been in the middle of this triangle. They've sort of been more inclined to side with the governor. The Senate leadership and the governor just really don't get along very well, at least relatively speaking. And the Senate is where you get a lot more of the sort of the far right Tea Party folks, you know. But the governor has been criticized even by some in his own party for not having enough of a leadership position in terms of policy. And he has protested that, in fact, he is leading in terms of policy. But when you look at the math, you know, the majorities, the supermajorities that the Republicans have in both chambers are so strong that it is completely veto proof. Even if a couple of folks wanted to uphold a veto just for, you know, for standards, you know, character. But, you know, so the governor really is sort of over a barrel in terms of what he can accomplish, you know, with the bully pulpit or behind closed doors.
Is there a political price to pay, though? If you have a Republican governor vetoing legislation passed by a Republican legislature and then they override, does this create a kind of political danger for all members of the party? Do they have to be careful, or is the governor not that strong?
I don't think they need to be careful. I mean, they've already overridden a veto of his, or two of them, I think. You know, honestly, you know, his numbers are not strong enough to carry anybody, you know, in the midterm elections, you know. And at this point, they're more interested. They were here for 2 years before McCrory was. Remember that. So they had already sort of worked out the sort of power arrangement before he showed up. And so, you know, his job and his challenge has been to figure out where to fit into that puzzle. And like I said, with the numbers being the way that they are, there's not a lot of room for a third party to come in and start dictating policy to two chambers who have their own very strong ideas about it.
Jorge, the governor's proposed cleanup plan for the coal ash spill. Lawmakers have indicated they want to come up with their own, yet another kind of division between the governor, legislative and gubernatorial executive power. Tell us about those plans and why the space between them.
This is another example of the differences that there are between the governor's office and the two chambers. Yesterday, what we had was that the governor's surrogates, the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, presented to the Senate what the governor's proposal is to deal with the 33 coal ash ponds that Duke Energy has across the state. The centerpiece of the proposal is that they would want to Duke to remove the coal ash from four of the ponds. These are near Asheville, near Wilmington, near Charlotte, and the one in the Dan River. And senators sort of just you know, they just sat there and they listened. They asked some questions. It was pretty diplomatic, but Senator Apodaca and Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger have both said that they want higher standards. They want to require Duke to do more about these coal ash basins. So we're expecting that, you know, presumably they're going to present something next week. It's going to be a lot more than what the governor has asked for. And then after that, the House would take it up. And then the House is also expected to perhaps even ask for maybe even more than what the Senate is asking. So we're looking at some differences there.
John Elliston in Asheville, how is this story playing out in Western North Carolina, the coal ash bill?
Well, we've watched it closely. We've got a coal plant in Asheville that is raising all the traditional concerns. And we're certainly following closely the work of Senator Tom Apodaca from Hendersonville close by, given that he's making some major moves on this front.
All right. On the State of Things today, we have a news roundtable. We're talking about mostly the legislature, and we will continue our conversation on the State of Things. We are from North Carolina Public Radio. It is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk with John Elliston from the Carolina Public Press, Laura Leslie from WRAL, and Jorge Valencia from WUNC when our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's our news roundtable today. John Elliston is with us reporting for the Carolina Public Press. He's in Asheville. Laura Leslie is Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL-TV. Jorge Valencia reports here on the radio for the legislature, well, for WNC, from the legislature. And Jorge, you've been following the fracking law in the state, which has now been signed.
Yeah, we had big news this week. It was really important no matter where you stand on this issue. The governor signed a law that is lifting a de facto moratorium that the state had on fracking. Now, this means that the state will be able to start issuing permits for fracking, as soon as next May. So just a quick recap, just to understand, where people are standing on this. Fracking is this form of shale gas extraction in which they pump millions of gallons of water into the ground with chemicals, and that helps extract the natural gas. This has brought a lot of money to states where it's being done. There's, I believe it's at least a dozen or 15 or 17 states that do this, Arkansas, Pennsylvania. Lawmakers here have gone to visit those states. They see that there's a lot of investment happening there. They see that there's a lot of money. Environmentalists, on the other hand, see that there's also a lot of problems that come with this, because sometimes there's contamination in the water. Sometimes there's earthquakes that happen as a result of this. But in the end, this week, the governor signed this law. There was, we were just talking just a moment ago about the differences between the governor and the two chambers. But this was, a senator was telling me that this was probably the biggest bill signing that they've seen the governor do. There was a lot of support. There were key members of both chambers there with him. There was the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. It seemed like Secretary Scavarla's entire staff was there. There was a lot of people, and they were pretty excited about it.
Big news, Laura, because it was signed, but not surprising news. This had been coming, and it was pretty obvious that it was going to go this way for some time.
Yeah, the train was on the track. There wasn't a lot of doubt. It was just a question of when. But it was it's interesting on a couple of points. One thing that, we had a lot of talk about how fracking was going to provide economic sort of energy freedom, energy independence for North Carolina and economic development and create a lot of jobs. But, the state's own Department of Commerce estimated that it would probably create no more than 400 jobs, period, in the entire time that the state gets fracked. And it's very unclear exactly how much gas is down there. But the most recent surveys by the U.S. Geological Survey say maybe enough to keep the state supplied with natural gas, not to replace coal or oil or anything else, for a few years. Of course, that's still nothing to sneeze at, and people who want to see us develop domestic energy say we should still do it. And we don't know how much gas is down there because, there's new technologies that might make more of it accessible. You don't know, there are definitely, it was being perhaps a little oversold, at least according to what we know now in terms of what the actual economic impact is likely to be.
And when is the earliest we could be fracked?
60 days after the department finalizes its rules. And this was a sticking point of the debate because when they passed the fracking law in 2012, one of the key points that they made over and over, supporters of that bill, is this is not the final vote on fracking. They told all the reluctant lawmakers, you will have another opportunity to vote on the rules before the first drill bit is sunk. This bill overturns that promise. It says, go ahead, we're not going to vote again on fracking. It's on.
So go ahead and do it before we even see the rules surrounding it.
Right. And they argue that they can still contest the rules if there's a problem. But that is a much more difficult administrative process to go through than the way it was set up in 2012, which is that the legislature had to take an affirmative action of actually voting to approve the rules before the fracking could start.
John Elliston, as we've said, it's unclear exactly how much natural gas we're talking about. The latest estimates show not a whole lot. And most of that seems to be in the Sandhills, which actually paints a funny picture. I think you imagine the U.S. Open with these plumes of natural gas flame shooting out the ninth hole. I just imagined that immediately when I heard that Sandhills is the base. Well, what about Western North Carolina? It doesn't seem to be that's a place where fracking has much impact. Is it a political issue given the environmental questions surrounding it?
Well, folks here were surprised and some were dismayed to learn fairly recently that the state will be testing in the westernmost counties for the potential for fracking. The conventional wisdom is that there's very little chance they'll find significant deposits there that would make it worth it. At the same time, the specter of mining of any kind in Appalachian Mountains carries a certain weight. We've been thinking about fracking as a phenomenon that would take place solely down east, as we call it. But the idea of it taking place in the mountains takes on a special importance for some folks, and folks have already started protesting. We had a protest just yesterday in Madison County that was pegged against fracking.
You know, the other fracture, I guess, that occurs in all of this is a kind of ideological fracture, because part of the rules or some of the legislation that surrounded fracking takes away a lot of local control, and a lot of individual property owners lose their individual property rights, which is the heart and soul of Republican ideological politics. A lot of that gets lost in fracking, huh?
Well, they're trying to recast that. If you listen to some of the House debate, force pooling is, you know, the idea that if, say, you know, you're in this big stretch of land, and if, say, 90% of the people around you want to frack and you don't, then you get fracked anyway. And they have to give you a share of the profits. And the reason for that is because natural gas flows like water. So if you stick a straw into your neighbor's yard and start sucking up the natural gas, they can pull it out from under yours too without even actually fracking under your land. So they're casting force pooling, the Republicans are at this point, as a way to protect people from having their property rights stolen out from under them, people who may be, as they put it, poor or uneducated and don't understand how the fluid dynamics work. So that's kind of how they're casting it. But, you know, in the end, the fact is that what this means is that people can own a whole bunch of land that they don't want fracking under and can be forced to do it. And that is, to some extent, you know, it does cut into property rights.
What about local jurisdictions? Some of them have had their rights restricted with regard to regulating fracking. Again, local control, a hot button Republican issue, not so much when it comes to fracking.
That's right. There was a provision in this Energy Modernization Act says that local governments can't really enact any type of ordinances that would restrict fracking. And the way that I think it was Senator Bob Rucho from Mecklenburg County, who's one of the lead proponents of this, framed it was that, you know, if we want to encourage companies to come here to the state and invest a lot of money, we can't have this like patchwork of laws for them to have to deal with. We need uniformity. Now, on the other hand, the governor actually he said that he was uncomfortable with making those restrictions on those local governments, but it stayed in the bill. It's now law. And I actually asked the governor about that at his signing, and he sort of suggested that that's still a piece that could move, because we have these pending rules that the legislature is going to approve next year. But it doesn't seem very likely that that's something that could change in those rules.
All right. Well, we've been talking about policy issues, but technically the short session is designed to make budget adjustments. What adjustments were made, Laura, and how many of them are important to all of us?
Well, at this point, we have two out of three important documents. Well, there's actually four. We have the Senate's ideas and the governor's ideas. The governor's ideas are a suggestion, because he doesn't actually have the power to write the budget. That's legislators. The Senate put its budget out last week with some very striking moves in it, one of which would be a large average 11% raise for teachers if they sign away their career tenure, their career status. But at the same time, it would actually kick thousands of people off Medicaid. Old, blind, disabled, medically needy people make a lot of cuts, other cuts in education. And so that was kind of a policy document in itself. I don't think you can really separate budget and policy, because, I mean, what you spend your money on tells you a lot about what you value, right? But we're still waiting to hear from the House. And that budget is supposed to be out next week. And after that, they're going to have to all come together and agree. And so far, you know, the House has said they don't agree with a lot of what the Senate put
out. And where's the governor in all of this? Is
watching.
He's watching.
No, he's working behind the scenes. He's working behind the scenes.
Yeah, and it is important to point out that while the pay raises go through, there are lots of other significant cuts to education that are going to have an important impact on classroom. And, of course, career status has to do with your ability to challenge your firing. So it raises lots of questions about what happens, especially to teachers as they advance, gain more salary, how easy it is to get rid of them and replace them. This is part of the critique that we've heard from teachers about this trade-off that they're being forced to make if they want to accept the pay raise, right?
Exactly. And, you know, as part of that, you know, with the Senate's proposal to give this significant raise to teachers, part of offsetting that cost is cutting teaching assistants. I think it's in second and third grade. So teacher groups have come out and saying, like, well, you're trying to help us, but at the same time, you're not trying to help us. And on the other hand, I think what we had with the governor's budget, or as Laura said, as the governor's suggestions, it would have also education-related, presented big cuts to the university system. And the Senate, the way that they've balanced that is that they left the university system untouched, at least in that regard.
All right, John, I know that some of the proposed budget measures have specific impact in the western part of the state. Tell us about those.
I think the one that matters the most in terms of its scale and import for us is a continuing appropriation for a Western crime lab. Right now, if law enforcement in Western North Carolina takes blood samples, say, for a DWI case or other toxicology work for various crimes, we have to ship it to the Triad or the Triangle to state labs there. Shipping it's not the issue so much as the fact that should that evidence show up in court here, we then have to get the analysts from, say, the Raleigh area all the way over here for court. And so as a result, we have a huge backlog in the processing of DWI cases. And this new appropriation will set up a new lab in Henderson County that just about everyone involved in law enforcement is pretty excited about.
All right. I did want to give short shrift to the Medicaid changes in the Senate proposed budget. Tell us about those in more detail, Laura, if you would.
Well, it has to do – I mean, it's kind of a technical change. But what it would do, it would have the effect of making a bunch of people who are now eligible for Medicaid assistance no longer eligible. Some of them would be able to reapply and perhaps get Medicaid, but some others probably would not. And you know what the Senate leaders said at the time was, well, those people are the people who have the most money of the needy, the least needy, and will be able to go onto the Affordable Care Act exchanges and buy their own insurance. But that a lot of these people, for example, disabled, developmentally disabled folks, people in nursing homes, are not going to be able to get the coverage for long-term care. They're not going to be able to get the kind of help that they need. And for a lot of these folks, Medicaid is, especially for the elderly, Medicaid helps to cover what Medicare doesn't. And so some of the concern, especially among people who are advocates for aging, is that, you know, a lot of these people are in Alzheimer's wards. I mean, they're in nursing homes. And without that extra money, they're not going to be able to stay there. And so where do they go? I mean, a lot of these folks don't have homes to go back to.
And of course, the big question around Medicaid in this state, and the reason that we kept 500,000 people from being eligible and rejecting federal money for Medicaid, was that the Medicaid system wasn't working, that it was broken. And how are we doing on fixing that? Because that was the reason so many people are left off the rolls.
They're trying to fix it. I mean, you know, and part of the problem is, as they say, it's inconsistent budgeting. You can't ever tell from one year to the next what it's actually going to cost you because prices go up, more people enroll. They're trying to get a handle on what they say runaway entitlement program, runaway spending. You know, and they point out they've spent $2 billion more than they were supposed to need to spend over the last 3 years on Medicaid. So clearly something needs to change, whether it's less care in the program or more money for the program. That, of course, is where you get into debate.
That's the debate. Jorge, you've been following action outside of the chambers, the latest with the Moral Monday protest. Where is that now?
Well, actually, their most recent protest rally did target specifically these Medicaid cuts. And what we had was a sit-in in the old Capitol building, which was where the governor's office is. We had a group of, I believe it was roughly around a dozen people, I think it was 11, who went in. They had a letter for the governor telling him why they thought that these cuts are hurting them. They're hurting a lot of people in the state. And they said, we're not leaving until we we can give this or we can say something to the governor. So what happened was at 5 o'clock when the building closed, the Capitol Police told, you know, other protesters who were there, reporters who were there, you know, say, you got to go, it's closed. And then the 11 protesters stayed. They were there for about an hour and a half. And then they came out to cheers. There were hundreds of people outside waiting for them, holding signs, complaining about Medicaid. Also, about the environment, you know, these other issues that we've talked about, you know, coal ash, fracking. And I don't know if it's too early to say that we have a theme, but it is the second time that we have a sit-in so far during this session with these Moral Monday protesters. The first time was 2 weeks ago, and it was at House Speaker Tom Tillis's office. We also had about a dozen people there who said that they wanted to talk to the speaker. He was in session. So, it was almost surreal. You could hear him in the hallways when they were there waiting for him. And then when the session was over, he was gone. And they were there until 2 o'clock in the morning. They were removed. They got citations for second-degree trespassing. Same thing last week, people waiting to talk to the governor. So I don't know. Like I said, maybe it's too early to see that it's a theme, but it makes me wonder if there's going to be more sit-ins.
And there might be more from the right. Carolina Rising has responded. Tell us about that.
That's right. So the Carolina Rising is a group that was started by Dallas Woodhouse, who's a longtime conservative strategist here in the state. And he's sort of right now he's presenting himself as sort of a foil, the conservative foil to the Moral Monday protesters. And what he had this week was that he was saying that there's actually that the state is coming back. A lot of people are getting jobs. Unemployment rate is going down. And so he called Moral Monday protesters gloomy. So he came out with there was a guy dressed in a suit to look like a sun.
Kind of like the Jimmy Dean sausage thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was handing out those stress balls, and they were in the shape of a sun. And there was a little bit of a drama because he went on the lawn where the Moral Monday protesters have a permit to have their rallies. And he says that the organizers' staff removed him from the lawn. He sent a public letter to Reverend William Barber, who's the head of the state NAACP, who's been leading this movement. And so, you know, we might have some tension there.
All right. Well, John, you know, it's easy for us, perhaps too easy for us to follow this, these protests and maybe make too big a deal of it here in the Triangle because that's where we live. How does it play out in the mountains? Does it have much impact?
It certainly does in pockets of the mountains. In Buncombe County, for example, we had what we called a Mountain Moral Monday a few months ago that was enormously attended, estimates ranging up to 10,000 folks. And we have plenty of folks who like to bus down to Raleigh for the protest. So it's certainly, at least among activist circles here, certainly on the radar and part of the dialogue.
All right. One more policy issue, Laura. We've got only about a minute left, but a proposal to create a public-private partnership for business development. What do we know about that?
Well, there's a couple different versions of it floating around. That's another one of those where there's two bills on a collision course. But basically what it would do is free up the Department of Commerce to, quote, move at the speed of business instead of the speed of government. Unfortunately, okay, one thing is it would not have the same transparency rules as government has now. So basically, there'd be a lot of public money. We're looking at a little teeny, teeny bit of private money and a whole lot of public money going into this thing. And then what happens to it, you can't tell because we don't have the same transparency as we have under the Department of Commerce. So there's a lot of concern about whether or not this is going to be a gigantic ethics mess waiting to happen, corruption. And there have been problems in other states with sort of cronyism, with corruption, with people doing self-dealing because they don't have to disclose the way that state employees would. So it'll be interesting to see which chamber's version of it moves ahead. The Senate version actually has a sort of a type of film tax credit in it. It's a grant instead of a film tax credit. But, you know, there are a lot of folks, obviously, down east very interested, well, and all over the state, very interested in seeing the film industry stay here. And it was interesting to see the Senate move on that sort of at the last minute this week.
And we do use public money now, but it's under state control so that it has transparency rule. But this would be public money now in private control.
Yes.
That's when business really loves the socialism, moving the people's money into that whole thing. That's
is
kind
that
of cool.
Redistribution of wealth? I'm not sure.
I believe in some ways it is, but we'd have to check. John, I've got about a second and a half, but I know that the GOP is going to be convening in the mountains soon. Tell us briefly about that.
That's right. This very weekend, 1,000 members of the GOP will gather in Cherokee for their annual convention. Highlights will be appearances by Mike Huckabee and Bobby Jindal, and should be quite the political bash.
All right. So it looks like a lot of fun. And, of course, the Democrats meeting in Raleigh at about the same time, right? So, John Elliston, reporter for the Carolina Public Press in Asheville, thank you so much. Laura Leslie, Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL, Jorge Valencia, WUNC's Capitol Bureau reporter, thank all of you for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we got two very young men, the Bucket Brothers, going to play live on the State of Things. Stay with us.